This is After Dark number 5. This is tape number 9. And this is side 1. And on this tape, we're going to be having an interesting roundtable with some of the DX Audio Service editors as we get asked some questions from you, the membership, as well as questions that Ann Nasha from News Radio 94 WCIT here in Lima asked us. And basically, what you're going to hear is an unedited roundtable. We did have to do a little bit of editing only because of time constraints, but for the most part, everything you'll hear will be from our session and questions asked. No holds barred. There are some interesting, lighthearted things, as well as some down-to-earth technical things, some questions that a lot of members have asked and wanted to know some answers on, and I think we did a pretty good job of this. So let's get right into our roundtable discussion here on the DX Audio Service After Dark number 5.
Might as well start off right at the top with the first question and the obvious place to start. How did the DX Audio Service start?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The DX Audio Service started back, let's see, it would have been about early part of 1985. A couple friends and I were sitting around having a few brews and talking about radio and such. And the comment came up about a couple blind friends of ours who were not able to get the access to normal material like you and I. I mean, we get the Radio World magazine broadcasting and such and just pick it up and read it. And there was really no magazine on the shelf on tape format that a blind person could read. And I just kind of made the offhand comment about, well, you know, it'd be kind of easy for us to read it. And there's certainly enough of us old radio bozos out there that were in the business and transferred over to television or some other media and would like to just kind of keep our fingers in it. So myself and four other guys just started picking up material out of different magazines. Here's DX News Magazine, for example, which is the printed magazine of the National Radio Club. And we just started reading some of the articles of interest and putting them onto cassette. And strangely enough, it just kind of evolved from there. And the format for the DX Audio Service basically just kind of meandered around for a year or so until we kind of found out exactly what we had to do to suffice the information. And I guess to put it to you bluntly, we just fell into it is the best way of putting it.
How many of you guys run this thing?
There's myself, John Bowker, who does the travelog and the historical moments. He's an ex-retired RCA man. Jerry Starr, who does the AM switch, is works over WHOT in Youngstown, Ohio. Phil Wayne does the market scope, and Phil was in radio for many, many years under the name of Chuck Rivers, the host with the most. And then he sold radio time. Yeah. Had to break into my radio voice there or something. Then he sold radio time, and now he's working in Findlay selling satellite systems. So it's one of those things where, you know, you've been in radio, you're hooked on radio, you're going to stay in radio. We also have Jim Snowbarger, which is one of our members, and he does this thing where we take a look at, you know, pick a town, like this month and last month we did Lima, Ohio. And what can you hear on the AM dial in Lima, Ohio? And, next month we'll go to some other town and just kind of see what's on the dial, so to speak.
Is there a lot of interest in this?
Yeah, there is.
A lot of subscribers?
You know, the interesting thing you find about it, and I'm sure that, the ownership of the station you work for would value this, is the fact that the average member of the DX Audio Service or the National Radio Club enjoy listening to AM radio. They like listening to Limbaugh. They like listening to, Brenner in the afternoon, the different talk shows, Bruce Williams and such. And you find that the typical audio service member can tell you more about talk radio than anybody else and can tell you from town to town. If you were to walk up to, say, a audio service member and say, okay, what station is Bruce Williams on in the state of Utah? I bet they can name just about every station that is an affiliate of his show.
It's quite a niche you guys fell into.
It is. It is. It's kind of interesting because it's basically an information media. You've got stations out there like your station and a lot of other news stations which cater to the news crowd. But then you got membership like we have in the DX Audio Service that cater to finding out about that information on the AM dial. And it gets interesting too because, I mean, there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of differences, there's a lot of things which happen in the industry, stations going on and off the air, stations changing format. you know, for example, I just found something interesting in one of our recent publications about a, you hear about stations that fight to get a nighttime signal. They're a daytime only station. We just found a station up in Michigan that is going, deleting their nighttime signal. Now, why would you want to delete a nighttime signal? I mean, it's beyond me, but it's interesting information to know.
Not selling enough commercials to make it worth paying the jocks.
They probably don't have any jocks.
Well.
Yeah, it's probably all satellite. That's why they're going off the air at night.
We had a couple of Fred Vobey groupies send in questions.
Uh-oh.
Cheryl and an anonymous both want to know how you got your start in radio.
It's kind of an interesting story because when I first got into radio, I had no intention of getting into radio. I was working, high school kid, what would it have been? Sophomore? Yeah, sophomore high school at Whitmer High School in Toledo, Ohio.
What year?
That would have been 1969.
You admit it.
Yes, I do. I am an old codger. I was in high school, and I found out about this little radio station, little FM station. I keep in mind, back in the 60s, FM was nothing. No one really thought FM would do anything. And there was a little radio station out in Berkey, Ohio, which is, I'm going to say, 18 miles to the west of Toledo. Had 105.5, and originally it was WGLN. And this was one of the hokiest little stations you could ever find. It was at one time it was a country station. Every jock's last name was Jones. So you had Casey Jones, you had John Paul Jones, you had Rufus Jones or whatever. I mean, all the last names are Jones. They was called the home of the Jones boys. Well, apparently the country format didn't cut it. They couldn't pay their bills, so they started doing progressive rock, and they had an ad for a janitor. And I thought to myself as a high school kid, well, this would be kind of a neat thing to do, you know, work in a radio station and take out the trash and talk to the jocks and stuff like that. So I started working at the station. They found out that I was fairly good with electrical stuff, so I repair the bulk erasers and the change the light bulbs in the ceiling and stuff like that. And one night, again, keep in mind, this was a progressive rock radio station, as some people call it, acid rock. And some of the nighttime celebrities would indulge, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in the production room, taking out the trash, and heard that little sound on the air of sound of a record just at the end. Looked through the glass and saw the jock just staring at the microphone. Walked in, Jim, and no acknowledgement. Jim, no acknowledgement. Well, here's a little naive Fred Vobey, not knowing I've never taken drugs in my life, never had more than one or two beers at a time. And I'm like, what's wrong with this guy? I called up the general manager and said, there's something wrong with Jim. I mean, he's sitting in his chair looking at a microphone. I don't know if he's asleep or what. And the general manager, honest to God, says, oh, okay, well, he must have taken some mescaline. Okay, wheel him back and go on the air. And I said, what do you mean go on the air? He says, well, you're going to have to put something on the air. I mean, it's going to be probably about an hour or so before I can get somebody in. So I wheel this poor guy back, and you know, he's still staring off into space. And I get on, played Spinning Wheel by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and went out into Magic Carpet Ride by Steppenwolf, and opened up the microphone, and WGLN in Berkey, Ohio. And here's the next record. Play the next record. And after that, that was it. I was in radio as an announcer, basically a fill-in, and went from there to a couple other Toledo stations. And when I graduated high school, and then worked around the Toledo and Detroit area for a while. And when I got out of college, I started making the trip around to the bigger cities.
Somebody else wants to know what your hobbies are.
Amateur radio.
Surprise.
Yeah, no surprise there. Love talking on the radio, as some people can figure out. Air check collecting. I like collecting tapes of radio stations, particularly things which I look at as historical. Something like, for example, maybe finding an air check of you when you were in your younger years on radio, and an air check of you now, and putting it on one tape is kind of a comparison. In fact, John Bowker has got air checks of, I'm trying to remember what her name was. Gosh, I'm losing it. There's a famous CBS female newscaster, and he's got an air check of her when she was at WHWH in Princeton. But anyway, the neat thing about air checks is looking back at them from a historical position and looking at what a radio station did back then versus what it's doing now. And sometimes you find some very interesting points. You find a lot of interesting history from the standpoint of your own personal views and usage on the air. Back in the 60s, for example, there was more professional news. There was more concise information given. It was presented in a very authoritative way. And now, at some of the smaller stations in Ohio, it's not uncommon to hear some 16-year-old kid mispronounce the state capital name or something. You did that back in the 60s and 70s, and you found the glass door hitting you on the tail as you were leaving with your paycheck, you know. So, you know, from a historical standpoint, it's kind of interesting listening to some of these tapes and getting these little clues that, you know, this is the way radio should be, but also finding out tidbits of information that you didn't know about what happened back then and how things were conducted.
When you're doing the air checks, do you ever see it come back around in a circle again?
That's an interesting question. A lot of programming decisions that are being made today are being made to give each station its own niche. Because what's happened in the last 12 or 15 years in just about every market across the country is a number of new radio stations coming on the air. And instead of a market having, let's say, five or six predominant radio stations, some media markets, for example, have 30 signals. If you go to New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, you're talking of markets that have 60 to 80 signals in the market. And that breaks up the radio audience quite a bit. In other words, the audience is very fragmented. And when you fragment a radio audience, every station has to find its own little niche, program just a little bit different from the other guy, and try to find a core audience that you can appeal to. You'll find that some programmers are very slick and professional, kind of the more traditional school of broadcasting. And you'll also find some programmers out there who are being very innovating and trying a completely different approach where they're not so slick and professional. And some of those stations are doing very well in various markets across the country.
Back in the 60s, WCIT had a very, very good news presentation. But when I first came to Lima in 1985, it really slacked off, and it wasn't that good. And now you're back with the all news, and it sounds, I think, better than a lot of the other stations in the market. That has happened in several markets where you've had a real good news presence. It's slipped down. Another station has taken it over, and now it's back up again. Same way with formats. You find a station which has basically had a good format, and then whatever reason they decided to go all polkas or something like that, and the station goes down to the dumpers, and now it's back up with something really decent. So, I mean, you see a lot of these turnovers and a lot of changes. You also see personalities change. You can kind of tell where the trend is going by where the personalities are going. And, you know, particularly in the bigger cities, you know, with Don Imus on WFAN and over in Chicago, for example. But it's one of those deals when you start seeing the big name personalities leaving a station, you know that station's destined for the toilet.
Speaking of changes, we have a question for John Bowker.
Okay.
John, with all the changes in broadcasting, what changes do you see?
Whatever happened to this operating in the public interest?
Oh, you mean from the famous FCC language? Public interest, necessity, and convenience? Is that what you mean?
I've heard that before somewhere.
I don't think anybody in the FCC knows either. In fact, during my years at the commission, when I would visit them on at least once, if not twice a week basis, and before they put in the ban against FCC commission and staff people having lunch with people such as me from NBC, we would have lunch with these people, and we just kicked around all kinds of things. There was never ever any hanky-panky. We were smarter than to try to pull a stunt like that. And one of the times we did, a fellow named James Quello, who is perhaps, he is the longest serving commissioner, was sitting beside me, and I said, Commissioner, can you tell me the meaning of public interest, necessity, and convenience? And he put his fork down, ho, 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 John, he said, nobody knows quite what they had in mind for that, I guess. Because that language comes from way back in the 20s, it predates the FCC. But then you stop laughing and you say, well, but doesn't it really mean that the radio has to serve a noble purpose? And he said, yes, that's of course what we're talking about. And he said the thing that worried him, and boy, I'll tell you this, Mr. Coelho, you know, he was at a broadcaster from Michigan up your way once upon a time, Fred.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was up in the Detroit area. He owned a station up there.
Okay.
James Coelho forecast the kind of thing that Howard Stern has now on the air. And I'm picking on Howard because he brought all the others with him, I guess. And that's just plain filthy junk that they put on the air that the Radio Commission and the Communications Commission, in turn, anticipated and wanted to make sure that the freedom of speech didn't get out of hand, as we now can see that it has got out of hand. Another personal opinion, so forgive me for that.
Well, I think there's a difference, though, John, between the Howard Stern and the filthiness versus you and I debating, say, politics like Limbaugh or some of these other guys would do.
The debate of politics is expected and anticipated and okay, fine. I think we're going to agree, Fred. So let me quickly break away from this part.
Okay.
The whole concept of broadcasting and the reason that the commissions, both radio and communications commissions, starting in 1927, wanted these big clear channel stations was to educate the public on matters going on in their government. That was the purpose of broadcasting. Herbert Hoover made this very clear when he said, and for pity's sakes, we can't allow any commercials to interrupt this or to be misunderstood. We don't want the government sponsored by Kellogg's Corn Flakes. This was a very famous speech that he gave in 1928 or something. I could be off a year or two. When he was commissioner or Department of Commerce back in those days is really when it happened. And so the debate of politics was not only expected but desired. Maybe not quite the way Rush does it, but maybe so. You know, I don't know. I can't read their minds.
Well, you know, does it really matter that much? Because when you listen to different radio stations, you hear the same formats on different stations. They call themselves the same things. They all read virtually the same liners. The only thing different is the call letters. Does it really matter if it all comes from satellite?
Probably one of the biggest reasons for programming a satellite service is economics. Obviously, if you're taking a lot of programming off of satellite, generally speaking, you're eliminating employees at the station. And the satellite services are very economical, maybe a couple hundred or $1,000 a month when compared to hiring a half a dozen employees or sometimes more to otherwise program the station. So usually economics is the determining factor in a satellite service. Obviously every programmer, if they had the budget to put on the air what they wanted to, would probably the last thing they'd want to program is satellite programming.
What you do with satellite depends on your commitment to the community.
Mm-hmm.
My gut instincts tell me you could take two stations here in Lima, put one station on. Let's take two stations in Lima, and put the same format on there. We'll take the Oldies Channel, for example. Okay, now the Oldies Channel on a satellite feed at the top of the hour, you get 6.5 minutes of open time for news. One station might just take ABC News Network, throw a few PSAs in, and 6.5 pass, boom, right back into the Oldies Channel. Another station might actually do some aggressive news. And I think that the wise thing to do is the aggressive news. I think a lot of station owners don't put a lot of credence into the intelligence of their audience. And they think that if they just have a signal on the air, that someone's going to listen to it. You have to have that local news. You got to have the local weather. You have to have the sports in order to draw an audience. And I think that's what a lot of people are forgetting. And I think I can substantiate that, I guess, to do my imitation of Rush. I can, right here in my formerly nicotine-stained fingers, if I did smoke, a lot of times Jerry Starr publishes in his AM Switch column here a list of silent stations. And it's always interesting when you read the list of stations which go off the air, it's always a station that just does nothing but music, just is a jukebox. You never see the station which actually does something with their format or plays material which you and I would find interesting. It's always the station that's just nothing more than flogging the hits and a few PSAs that is going under.
Well, Fred, of course, that's true. Now, you are very close to radio operations and can see the way automation is taking over, particularly when the use of satellites already has come into the regular AM and FM broadcast stations, and I'm sure that's what you mean, because all you need do is have your chief salesman come in about 8:30 in the morning and sit down at a microphone and record three or four different versions of the same weather forecast, make sure the commercials that he sold the day before are properly stacked into a music box kind of arrangement, mm-hmm. sets his little computers to swing them in and out as needed, and then he goes off and sells more time, and the whole station can be run by, one or two people. I was interested to see today in the Tampa newspaper, the Tribune, that one of our stations that's mixed up, and this is television now, but it's telling, I believe, that one of the TV stations that mixed up in the swap of Fox and ABC and CBS, and that's going on in many, many markets all over the country. The new Fox station in town is going to have a news crew of 77 people to put on the 6 o'clock and the 11 o'clock news. 77 people for that one portion of their broadcast day. In radio, that's probably done by, Fred, you make a guess, one person perhaps for the entire broadcast?
Yeah,
so don't we see that radio is leading the way very strongly in this whole matter of news? Let me interrupt myself for a minute. When I was working with a CBS station in Burlington, Vermont in the late 40s, our news crew there, they had three cars. Really and truly, they had three automobiles. This is to cover the city of Burlington, Vermont, and I'll let you look that up in your atlas as to, how much there is to cover in a city like that. And the news staff, there were always two people on the air, such as you and I are right now, Fred, and they, I don't know how big a crew they must have had a dozen people in the news staff of a 5,000-watt CBS radio station. Now it's maybe one, as you point out, and perhaps that newsman is also heard on the other two stations in town through some local marketing agreement.
I think the answer to that question depends more on the format of the station than anything else. For a background-type format, in other words, the kind of station that you tend to put on and just leave on in the background all day, it probably matters very little to the average listener whether that's being satellite-delivered or whether it's locally programmed. Now, a foreground station that people listen to for local information and a station that has a history of providing good local coverage of events and information, to take that away and change to a satellite service would probably be a major minus. In the particular case of talk radio, satellite-delivered programming has probably been a savior for a lot of stations. Rush Limbaugh doesn't work at your local station, nor does G. Gordon Liddy. So in the case of some of the very successful talk stations, satellite-delivered programming is at their very core. In the case of some smaller market stations that are operating on a very tight budget, and in many cases operating in the red, the question then becomes, does it really matter to an audience if the station programs a satellite service or goes off the air?
Now, there are some stations in some markets that have been extremely successful programming, satellite programming throughout much of their broadcast day. For example, a lot of the nostalgia and big band formats like Stardust and the old Music of Your Life. A lot of those stations were very successful because the format was extremely well presented. They made some attempts to make the station sound local and employed some very good announcers and used some very good programming techniques on the stations. And those have all been pretty good and generally have done, as long as the format was on a good facility, generally have done pretty well.
With station managers looking for budget cuts all the time, what do you think is going to happen to radio in the future?
I don't think that you have to cut the budget so severely that you have to eliminate your local content. Without tipping my hand, so to speak, I was involved in working a deal to purchase a station, and I did a lot of number crunching on, who do you keep? Who do you have? What do you need to make a station run? Now, on one side, I could say, okay, Ann, I'm going to have a radio station, And I'm going to give away 10,000 t-shirts and 40,000 coffee cups to my clients and my listeners. And I could take all that money there, and budget that toward promotion. On the other hand, I can take and put people into operations such as news, public affairs, and sports, and recoup the investment of their salaries through added revenue. I think a lot of times general managers, especially in radio, which it tends to be an egotistical media, not that anyone would notice that, they tend to look at some of the softer areas of promotion versus looking at themselves as a way of promoting themselves. I think a lot of stations, such as in our market here, could do a lot better if they did something with themselves versus try a contest route or try to spice it up through jazzy jingles and such. The best promotion a station can have and the best way of generating their own revenue and bolstering their sales is by giving somebody something to listen to. And I think people like to listen to their local news, sports, weather, find out what's going on, and to a certain part have a little bit in there of themselves in the broadcast. They like to hear, for example, somebody from say Bath High School talking about the sports and stuff, and hear that person that they may know on the air doing an actuality. And I think that's why when you talk about these stations that play just network news and that's it, that's why they lose out, because there's not that interest.
With each station today searching for a niche audience, a significant little chunk of the market that a station can program to, can appeal to, can get that part of the market talking about so that they're well known in the community, you're starting to see a lot of stations take the old basic formats and kind of expand on them or chop them up. For example, you've seen the old twangy country music go to they've got Young Country now, they've got Country Gold, they've got the to mention a satellite format, Real Country, which is kind of twangy. You've got an easy country, so the country format, for example, has fragmented into various types of country music. You've had your top 40 fragmented into modern rock, urban. You've got your hot adult contemporary formats. There's just so many radio stations today. And everybody looking to find that niche, and a lot of stations cutting their budgets because the advertising dollars that were there may not be there. Or for a station that relies exclusively on the ratings, if the ratings don't keep them in the same rank in the marketplace, you may find with managers cutting budgets and declining ratings and all that more and more stations might be looking to either adjust their format, change their format, and so on. If you look at the major players in any market, the KDKA Pittsburghs, the WGN Chicago, I'm trying to think who we got out in Los Angeles, perhaps KABC. And I don't mean necessarily to just bring up the news talk stations. But if you look at the stations in each market that have put together a long-term plan for being that market's dominant station, you'll find that those are the stations that are typically billing the most. They've been consistent in their format the most, although they are not afraid to change with the times. A lot of the stations have been, like the KDKAs have been the station for adults, for news, for information in that market. And they have always been known for that. And when anybody wants to know, what's going on in the Pittsburgh area, they tune to KDKA because that has always been the station that's been at the forefront of being the real public service station in Pittsburgh. So, unfortunately, I hate to see stations programmed entirely by economics alone. Okay. In other words, if you want to cut the budget, let's just be cheap about everything. I think we have to be innovative. And you're starting to see that in a lot of markets now with stations looking for their niche audiences. More and more stations are trying to be innovative, stand out, and be different. And that's one of the effects that you've seen over the last couple of years, plus the emergence of different types of formats. The big format for the last year has been the 70s music, both 70s top 40, and in some markets, 70s classic rock. The new format that's emerging on the scene right now is the emergence of from top 40 to a alternative rock, modern rock type of format that still has some of the top 40 formatics and still has some of the energy and the excitement of the top 40, but they're playing a different kind of music than you'd hear on your local adult contemporary station. So there's all kinds of innovation going on today, and I think that's good for the radio business.
Well, in many stations, a little bit of belt tightening will provide the cuts that are necessary to keep the ship afloat. And in that case, it may be a decision as to whether you buy a new copy machine or how much paper do you keep in stock or how many long-distance calls can people make and things like that. So in many cases, belt tightening doesn't ultimately affect the way the station sound or the way the listeners perceive the station is sounding. So a well-run operation can probably do a considerable amount of cost-cutting without affecting the way it sounds on the air. Now, in the case of a station that's in trouble to begin with, often you'll find them jumping from one format to another. Whatever they perceive the latest miracle format is, they'll go to that, try it for a little while. They don't have the financial backing to stick it out long enough for the format to establish itself or prove itself, and after a couple months, they panic and move on to something else. Stations like that have a history of doing things like that, will probably continue to operate like that. It comes down to management, I think.
Do you think there can be a happy medium between semi-automated, semi-live, so the station manager is saving the money and yet having some involvement?
Sure. With the digital systems, your station's got Scott Studios, I believe
right.
It is. Okay. Scott Studios, there's one by Arrakis called Digilink. There's the one we use here in our studios called The Editor. There's numerous systems which basically take away the mundane duties of an operator. I'm sure that if your personnel at your station had to record Dr. Dean Adele, somebody had to physically walk up there and load a tape and record that, and had to record all the different feeds and all the different commercials that come down on your net line, you'd have to have five or six more people mm-hmm. there. And also, your overnights would have to be staffed with somebody who can take and assemble all that material. I think computer systems have helped us in that respect, because it's able to take away a lot of the boring duties, the unproductive duties of people. Therefore, the smart general manager or owner can say to an Ann Nashif or Russ Michaels or anyone, tell you what, I'm looking for a good person to do good news. We want you, or we want this person to be that good person. And here are the tools that you have to be able to do that good newscast. We can take away the responsibility of taping this. We can take away the responsibility of sitting down there with a razor blade and splicing tape and cutting that actuality up, because we got a computer system that'll do it a lot faster. Therefore, you can take and make your staff a lot more efficient. The trouble is with these systems is the fact that it's very easy for an owner to sit back and say, no, wait a second. No, maybe I don't need a Russ. Maybe I don't need an Ann. Let's just
heaven
take...
forbid.
Yeah. Well, we'll make sure Marty doesn't hear this tape. it would be very easy for somebody to take and program that system so it jumps out of the satellite network, satellite network at the top of the hour, goes into ABC, plays three PSAs, and jumps back in. That's where they get into trouble. It works for a while until the audience catches on and says, no, wait a second. I didn't hear about that news story. I didn't hear about that house that burnt down on the other side of town. Whatever happened about, you know, this? And especially weather. That's the one thing I've always noticed. People like to be informed on the weather. And they like to know what to expect and what is going to happen. Albeit sometimes it's not entirely correct. It's not a complete science. But, you know, a station, like, for example, if I'm traveling across the United States, if I'm listening to the radio and that station doesn't give a news weather forecast at least once 15 minutes, you know, usually I turn out. I, you know, because I kind of like to know, okay, I'm I'm heading out to North Dakota. Now, what's that weather like that I'm going to be driving into? And just about anyone with any intelligence likes to know what's going on, and weather forecast is number one. News is second. Sports, I'd say, is third. And there's a lot of people around that would gladly support local sports if they had it. But unfortunately, it does take a little bit of investment, and that's where the owner themselves has to kind of sit back and weigh their options. Do you do away with the sports and the news and the weather and take what you saved in not having a person on the air? Or do you put a person in that position, a news person, into an on-air position and by having a good news, sports, and weather on your station, be able to recoup that in advertising?
Well, somewhere in the great cosmic universe of broadcasting, there probably is a happy medium between saving money and keeping quality programming on the air. And I guarantee you, if I knew the answer to that question, I would probably be the richest man in broadcasting.
You know, one thing our station did, instead of having a DJ sit in the studio for 6 hours and basically punch a button every 4 minutes, they can do their entire show now on the computer in half an hour, lay down their voice tracks, and now we have them out doing remote broadcasts. Mm-hmm. They're out doing promotions, and they're out there being seen instead of sitting in the studios.
Yeah, and there's even some stations which are experimenting around right now with a new technology, which is basically, it's along the lines of, I'll say, for example, now, this is kind of a bad example because we're both in town here. And in fact, we're only about a half a mile from your station. There are some stations which are experimenting around now with a system where I would record my voice tracks on my digital system, and then I send them through the phone line to your digital system, and then I can be on the air on your station. And I don't even have to go over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology is there now to where you can do that from New York to California, and it's no sweat.
Carts were around in our business for 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
Do you think this digital system is going to be here for that long, or do you think there are going to be other evolutions coming real quick on its heels?
I think you're going to see two basic forms come up. Right now you've got the digital systems where you can call up stuff from the hard drive and edit and produce and such. I think down the road you're going to start seeing things such as a cassette recorder, which is completely digital without even a hard disk in it. It'll just be a big, basically a RAM chip, which will memorize it. You'll go out and do an interview with the mayor, and it'll actually record onto this random access memory. When you get back to the radio station, you plug your cassette recorder into, in your case, your troll at your system, and just play that back in. And when you get done with the actuality, you hit the race button, and you can go out and do some more. I think the digital technologies are going to get refined to the point where you as a news person or anyone who's in the business can take and compress down more information faster and quicker than what is currently available. I think the next step after that is the ability to be able to disseminate that information to a multitude at a cheap rate. Right now, like, for example, if your station was to start a news service to furnish to other stations, you'd have to have phone lines or you'd have to have microwave lines to feed that out. And they're expensive. But I think there's going to come a time when there's going to be a technology available, and it's probably going to happen within the next 10 years as Spectrum opens up, where you'll be able to take and ship a signal from your location to another location, even if it's out of town, at a very cheap rate. Because data transfers are going to start to really, really go down in price. For example, the digital systems here, when they first started up, they were $10,000. Now, easily, you can get a editor system like we've got here for $3,500. I imagine a year down the road, it's probably going to be $2,500. Technology keeps decreasing price.
There's a big advantage that digital equipment has over the old mechanical cart machines and tape decks and so on. The digital equipment has very few moving parts. And with moving parts, you have maintenance and failures and all that. And one of the biggest advantages of digital is getting away from all those moving parts that require engineers and provide a lot of downtime and expense to a station. The other advantage, obviously, is the neatness in which you can edit And Fred with his digital editor is certainly witness to that. The excellent sound quality. And also, another big factor is the superb signal-to-noise ratio that the digital equipment has. You can do a number of dubs on digital, in fact, just about an infinite number of dubs, and still come up with audio that's as clean as the original.
I think that's a natural progression of technologies. Moving magnetic tape has been around since World War II, and having had a chance to work with digital audio, I find that once you get over the intimidation factor, it's a lot easier to work with. Editing no longer requires a razor blade and a piece of tape and a splicing block and splicing tape and all that mess. It just requires moving a cursor around on a screen. It's also a lot handier for making copies, because in digital mode, the 15th copy that you make is just as pristine as the original. So there are many advantages to digital. The big holdback right now, I believe, is cost. And once more units, digital workstations become available on the market, and competition between manufacturers drives the cost down, I think you'll see more and more radio stations going to digital processing as far as in-house goes. Now, of course, to answer the rest of the question, what's the next move? I think the next move, the next big change in radio, will be digital reception in the home. Right now in Cincinnati, there is an experiment going on in which digital audio is being transmitted over a standard AM broadcast facility. Those who have heard the receiving end say that it's just as clean as any other digital audio, and that, of course, could pump a lot of revitalization into a sagging AM industry. It would, as they say, level the playing field between AM and FM. I believe that in not too many years, you will start to see digital transmission of audio into the home. And I believe you will see it on both AM and FM, and particularly in AM. In AM mode, digital transmission eliminates a lot of AM's shortcomings, such as natural and man-made noise and limited frequency response. And I believe that my crystal ball is telling me that that is the next big move in radio.
Do you think these will eventually be in the home? We were talking the other day at the station about, I mean, why couldn't you have like 500 songs on your home computer and you line them all up and it just goes forever?
Yeah. I think that's going to happen. I think it's eventually going to be a situation where you connect your computer to fiber, and that is going to be the one thing which is going to lock in all this technology is a fiber signal, because right now on a phone line, even with a modem, fastest you can transmit is about 57 kilobaud signal, which is not extremely fast for an audio signal. With fiber, you can transmit on one piece of fiber up to about 7 different signals back and forth. So you can have your telephone, you can have your cable TV, and your data line. And with that data line, I think there's going to come services where you can be able to interconnect with, say, a Camelot music and say, I really like rhythm and blues. Give me all the rhythm and blues selections. And that downloads into your computer. You parse out what you don't like. Discard it basically to Big Byte Heaven, and then you have yourself a catalog in your computer of just what you like to listen to. There are now experimentations going on with the, the Voice of America and with Radio Netherlands, where they're taking newscasts and features, and they're putting them up on internet, and then you can download these newscasts and stuff to your own personal computer. Now, the only problem with it now is to get, say, a 5-minute interview or something, it's some incredible large computer file, and it takes like about 20 minutes to do. But again, the fiber is going to be the key, because once you get that fiber in everyone's home, you can get that information out a lot faster and a lot quicker. And it's going to be nothing for you to call up your parents and say, hey, you want to hear something? Patch into this or whatever you have to do, and you can send down something, a song that you recorded in your living room that day, and when it comes out at the other end, it'll be CD quality audio. But it's that fiber that's gonna make or break it. And that's all the time we have on Side 1 for our roundtable. We'll pick it up on Side 2 of the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service, After Dark number 5, tape number 9, with more comments and DX information, so stay tuned.